generally, I was really very much preoccupied with my own research. I took seriously these questions of academic liberty, but they were not in any way the top of my mind. I was not engaged in consulting in Washington during that era.
I don't know what your time constraints are.
1:30 is fine. We've got another half hour.
Okay. Maybe we could finish up the Wisconsin period this afternoon.
Well, then I want to go back over some of the thematic questions.
Do you want to do that now, then?
Is there any more about Wisconsin, narratively speaking? What do you think?
You've discussed much of your work there. You went to associate professor.
Yeah, the nitty-gritty, the scientific details in the papers. You don't need oral history to
when I
like that.
You were promoted associate professor in 50, and I'm not sure when to
whatever date is. It's in the records
in there somewhere.
Pretty fast. I think I was the youngest professor ever appointed there.
Well, certainly you must have been like 27 or something like that.
Maybe. Something like that.
Yeah. So.
Ditto, I got in the National Academy fairly young, too.
I'm not sure if there's anything else about that. You know, we can talk about the reasons for going to Stanford and all of that. You've talked about the getting genetics in the med school finally, but you had some frustrations with that, though, didn't you, eventually?
At Stanford?
No, at Wisconsin.
Oh, well. That part, yeah. Well, we got started. There was some ambiguity about what scale it was going to be, what the funding was. That slowed me up in terms of recruiting. We didn't really get very far during the time I was there. I think it really didn't go operational till 57. So it was about 55 was the formal establishment, as I remember. Probably did get to where we taught at least one year's medical class. I mean, the teaching was the thing that was the operationally unique step on the matter. But med school as a whole was undergoing a lot of changes at the time, and things hadn't shaken down very far during the time I was still there. What else? No very striking differences. Still, well, it did mean starting from 55, I did end up being busier and busier with administrative detail, just trying to get things moving. I'm sure I don't have any clear images of it, but I must have been spending 20-25% of my time just trying to pull all the pieces together, get the funding and that kind of thing. So that was my evolution in that direction. I think up to that point I would have been either in the classroom or the library or in the lab, and no reason to be anything else.
Did your graduate student level stay pretty much the same?
Yeah, I would have 2-3 at the most, maybe one postdoc at any given time. A pretty small lab. I didn't squawk very loudly about it. I didn't realize what influence I might have had. Wouldn't have been easy, but I think I could have swung more space. And there must have been some of that getting ready in the medical school, which I don't think I ever got to occupy. There was some new building going on. That was part of what could have eventuated there. Funding was adequate for what I was looking for. NIH was coming into play, and my first grant was for $3,000, but it started growing after that. And I did end up having most of my support eventually from NIH grants. It started out with the Rockefeller Foundation and WARF and a little bit of department money that I mentioned to you. Let's review Wisconsin from that perspective. Uniqueness, well, very young fellow, pushing right along, pulling the department together. The issue of precocity becomes less and less as, you know, eventually did get to be 25 after that. It's less of an issue. I'd say by that time I would not have, if there was anything unique, it would have been not a qualitative singularity, just having a very active, intense research program in an area of major interest, but there might have been 15 or 20 others more or less like that at that point. So I slipped much more of the generic aspects, and there I think was the model of an active research scientist. That was my life model at the time. I felt very excited about what was happening from day to day, and I think fairly content. I felt a little bit restless about sort of the larger philosophical frame of the lack of a medical involvement was an issue. The could have done more about other elements of culture, and I don't want to depreciate them. Wisconsin's not totally bereft of them by any means. Wasn't quite the excitement that one experienced either at Berkeley or at Stanford. I guess that's true today too. It's a good school, and certainly don't want to appreciate that it might not be the very top of your list. A few outstanding individuals. So I was probably as close then to living out my life model as at any time. That was the very, very core of how I would have viewed myself. I was probably itching for more application. That here I was making an important contribution to the substratum of biological investigation. I think I had a pretty both large and realistic view of how important it was. I don't think I underestimated it in any way, and it was wonderful fun being right in the middle of the action. I always wanted to keep an eye out for how can you make something useful out of what you're doing, and that wasn't eventuating. It wasn't happening at Bristol, and I didn't see too many other avenues for doing much about it. So I just thought, okay, you publish your work, others will pick it up, and it'll come to mean something someday. Decision points, I think we've covered the main ones. Going to Wisconsin in the first place, not being more ambitious about growing in space and funding and so forth, although I could also wonder if I might not have overplayed my hand if I pushed it any further. It was, in retrospect, I think not. I had more potential power and influence than I understood or acknowledged at the time. It was only when the issue came about my leaving there that I realized that people really would care to that degree. I mean, I don't mean that they were careless, but that there might have been a way to get the deans to try to undertake some special measures. The Enzyme Institute had far better laboratory facilities than I did, and you know, one thing I might have done would have been to try to press for membership in that. It just never occurred to me to ask for things like that. So I was, may seem a strange thing to say, but unduly modest on that score. Decisions about trying to set up a medical school, that was getting on the slippery slope, but I can't see how I would have or could have done otherwise. And then eventually deciding to leave there. So I think we've covered the major issues. What else was going on in biology during that decade? That's a lot of homework. I don't think I'll... there's not much that oral history in my own recollection would add to trying to do a piece of scholarship. But in fact, let me get something out for you, and you take a look at it and bring it back. Okay. I'll give it to you for you, because in fact I've written a history of what I call the Vicennium, and that's 1930 to no, it's just before this, 1930-1950, which I see as the crucial flowering of microbiology and bringing it into the modern era. But it's not quite the right interval for this one. It's certainly the playing out of the DNA story is the big thing that was happening during that time. A lot of activity in Paris. The beginnings of the messenger RNA, enzymatic induction, so on. That was the real center of the action at that point. Further details on DNA structure, the corroboration, bolstering, nothing nearly as revolutionary as DNA. You sort of have to get to the end of that decade before you in a sense have the RNA story starting to emerge with the genetic code and so on. So, but that is relevant to my own situation, because here I was still doing experiments with the technology of 1946, when the field was becoming increasingly more dominated with biochemical inputs. I was picking up some of them. I wrote a paper on beta-decalaxidase, but I really wasn't adequately equipped to do serious molecular biology, and that was harder then than it is now, because you needed ultracentrifuges. We didn't have gel electrophoresis and things of that sort, just wonderful further assistance. And that is one of the reasons I left Wisconsin, is that I wanted to be in an environment at least where work of that level and that kind was going on, and I had some better chance of participating in it. And Arthur Kornberg was my attractive magnet from that point of view at Stanford. Take home messages. Well, I wasn't much involved in popular culture at that time. I would have to look around. I think I did have a letter to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, in which I said, you're making a big fuss about radiation damage, and let's measure it, and that's okay, but nobody has said anything about chemical mutagenesis. And I think that was the first public mention of it. That was in 1955. I remember some correspondence with H.J. Muller, asking him what he thought about that, and he said, yes, that is an important issue, and should we try to take it to the academy? And he was a member then, I wasn't, and so nothing came of it. There was no receptivity to that. Seems crazy today. Environmental mutagens everywhere.
Yes.
So I do think that was the introduction to that subject. A couple of people had done experiments with chemicals, as I had done, but not made that extrapolative leap to, yes, these are a public health hazard, no less and no more than radiation is, for comparable reasons. I can't think of any other public issue I came in on that is special to my own science. I had some loose affiliation with progressive politics in Wisconsin. It was an extraordinary state from that point of view. It had the La Follette kind of tradition. Civil liberties were, I forgot what the hot challenges were, but I did belong to the ACLU at that time. But those were second order matters. I mean, the lab was really the main focus of interest. Social relations, lab environment, I think I've described that to you, was fairly stable in the cast of characters. The names are in the record, there's no point trying to... I don't remember them nearly as well as I can find the detail. Gatekeepers were pretty friendly. I was I wasn't asking for very much, so I got all I asked for on grants. Papers were published without any problem. I started getting a few papers for review now and then. I should look up when I started going on NIH study sections. That would have been my first connections with Washington. It was during that period, probably the early 50s. I was starting to sit on some of the study sections. Oh, I should bring up something, and that's Gene Garfield.
Oh.
He published a paper in 1955 about the concept of citation indexing, referring to Shepherds in the law.
Mm-hmm.
And already, though I was already interested in literature, in scientific literature quite deeply at that time, the paper made an important impression on me, just something to worry about, file away and keep. Two or three years later, I asked myself, I wonder what ever happened to Gene's Garfield's idea. I'd not met him. I knew about current contents, used it, nothing more than that. And then it hit me that that was a self-exemplifying question, that if there were a citation index, I would know how to answer the question, and that that sort of thing would come up over and over again. So I wrote to him and said, what's happened to it? What are you going to do about it? So I started my relationship with him, I think that's early 58, and it might have been slightly earlier than that. He said he didn't quite know where to go. I'm not sure who brought up what first. But the idea eventuated about applying to the NIH for a grant to do a demonstration. I told him I'd be agreeable to being an advisor to his project. So it was submitted to the genetic study section. And since geneticists have an instant reflex about generational relationship of parent and descendant, which is analogous to paper and bibliography, they can understand the idea of citational networking instantly. It's amazingly difficult to explain this to others sometimes. So they very promptly supported the concept and awarded a small grant to just demonstrate it, produce a sample genetic citation index, and that was done. I was, as I say, an advisor to it, and looked like the thing could work, and there was a sufficient bulk of exemplary material to give you a sense of just how useful it would be. It was still fairly primitive and didn't have had very abbreviated citations, and everything had been done on punch cards. A little bit of mainframe computing for what was available in those days. And it inspired Gene to say, okay, this thing looks like it might work, and there's enough interest in it out in the community, I'm going to see if I can make a business of it. And I remember saying, Gene, don't do that. You're going to lose your shirt. You'll never break even on it. Well,
yes, there they are.
Well, and especially on the it also reflects a fairly early interest I had in using computers for some useful purposes in science, but that was the beginnings of the citation index and my relationship with Gene. I think he got started on it, and then in the very early 60s, 61 maybe, he asked me to if I would join his board, and offered to allow me to make small investment in the company at that time. So I think it was his first shareholder, as a matter of fact. That was the best investment I ever made. Gene did make a profit out of the SCI,
in spite of your prediction.
Yeah. So that's something I feel pretty proud about, having had some part in this.
Yes.
Then also exobiology started during that interval. We haven't said anything about that yet. Of course, Sputnik was the incident of that. I've already done some oral history on that one, though. Steve Dick is a historian at the U.S. Naval Observatory, and he did an interview with me just a couple of weeks ago, focused on just that episode, so I think I won't repeat that here.
Okay.
We'll get the text of it and we'll share it. But there's not too much overlap with the other stuff we have going here. But it relates to how I met Carl Sagan, got him introduced to NASA, and but it began with Sputnik, which sort of made things possible. I'd had background interest in the question of whether there could be life elsewhere than on Earth, but never saw any way to do anything about it, so it was left in the realm of pure speculation. And Sputnik seemed to open an era where that might possibly eventuate, and I got to be quite active on that from that point. I haven't said anything about theories of antibody formation. That was also still there in my Wisconsin days. I've written a memoir on that. Have you got a copy of that? The ontogeny of the clonal selection theory.
I'm not sure that's in the file.
I better get you that. Anyhow, that's been pretty thoroughly written down, and I can't think of too much that would add to that. The background on that was a Fulbright fellowship, which I took to go to Australia for a few months, just a little bit of wanderlust. I'd never had a sabbatical up to that point. And I was going to work with Mac Burnett in Melbourne, ostensibly on genetic recombination in the influenza virus. He had discovered a system of genetic exchange there. And he was a wizard at flu and knew nothing whatever about genetics, and I thought might be a useful reciprocity in that. when I got there, he told me he had dropped working on that subject and that he was working on the theories of antibody formation. And I've written about this now, again, in another memoir, some detail. All this was while I was still at Wisconsin, so it is part of that. That was pure. I did some experiments with Nossel, Gus Nossel, who is now the Burnett's heir, is the director of the Paul Institute in Melbourne. He's been there for some time now. And they did support the view that single cells produce only one species of antibody, and that an animal making a lot of different antibodies, it's segregated cell by cell, which is part of the clonal selection theory, and which is now universally accepted. Ken Schaffner has written a little bit just recently. I got a paper from him on the acceptance of the theory. And I think he's done a pretty good job of filling in that detail. That's still something I feel I want to go into in a little more detail someday, of the resistance to it. Both Burnett and I faltered for a while. It looked like there was damning evidence, and we believed in evidence, trying to find some way to rescue it. It still seemed like a very good idea fundamentally. And then the negative evidence turned out to be an artifact. Mm-hmm. And it was good as gold all the way. And it's now the common dogma. So that was a tiny experiment. It was centered on a going away, a distractional experience. But it had wonderful fruits. And that may have been the first time I really saw how far one could go with purely theoretical speculation if you had a good firm background. That's without doing much experiment. I had done that before, but I'd always done my own experimentation after that. But there was a limit to how much one could do in one's own lab. I had my first brush with computers at Wisconsin in the early 50s, 53 I would guess. I took a course on the plug board program, card machines, then decided, although you could do standard deviations with a whole pack of cards, it wasn't worth it. I didn't see much more to do at that stage, but just keeping an eye out for what computers might be useful for someday, and sort of kept it in reserve. My first contact with those machines was in 1941, when I was a high school student and attending the, I think I may have mentioned this before, American Institute Science Laboratory. Do you want to switch?